Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Ethical Society Mid-Rivers. We are very excited to welcome our guest speaker this morning, Dr. Margaret Placentra Johnston. Dr. Johnston is the author of the books Overcoming Spiritual Myopia and Faith Beyond Belief, Stories of Good People Who Left Their Church Behind. Dr. Johnston holds a Bachelor of Arts degree and a Master of Arts degree in Education from the Catholic University of America. She also holds a Bachelor of Science degree and a Doctor of Optometry degree from the Pennsylvania College of Optometry. Her talk this morning is titled, Time for a Bigger Story. Join me in welcoming Dr. Johnston.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
If I ever, my voice does tend to trail off, so if you ever can't hear me, just let me know and I'll speak up again. First, I want to thank my host here in St. Louis, Mary Ellen and Andy Stanton. I was mainly coming here to visit them, and Mary Ellen said, well, as long as you're coming, why don't you speak at Mid-River? So I also appreciate this opportunity, and I want to thank Jill and Bill all, and also Tom for helping me set everything up. So I think maybe you all have the idea. He just said I went to Pennsylvania College of Optometry, so I'm a doctor of optometry, and I've spent a career so far about 36 years correcting vision disorders. And the most common of all vision disorders is myopia. Does anybody know what myopia is?
Nearsighted,
right, exactly. So I can see a few of you in myopic glasses. I can tell by the way your glasses look. So myopia means that you can, without your glasses on, a person who is myopic, they can see close, but they can't see far away. So we can say they're short-sighted and they're nearsighted. And that means they're kind of, without the benefit of glasses, they're blinded to what's out there in the bigger world. So they really can only see what's close to them. Now, over the years I've been writing prescriptions for glasses and contact lenses to treat myopia, it's become obvious to me that in our general overall culture, we suffer from an overall societal and cultural myopia as well. And my own particular area of interest is in what I call the spiritual aspect of it, so I call it spiritual myopia. So you might wonder, what in the heck is she talking about? What is spiritual myopia? Well, I like to characterize it in two ways. One is, you know, all of our competing religions, when you really think about it, it's kind of ridiculous to think that one could be right and all the others are wrong. And then, you know, the beliefs, they're held in a literal way. Well, when you look at the bigger overall picture, you know, how could only the beliefs that were revealed to your culture be right and the beliefs revealed to all the other cultures would be wrong? That's just not possible. The other thing that's myopic about our competing religions is that a lot of them are based on an outer authority. In other words, you're told what to believe by your holy book or your preacher or your religious authority, and you're not encouraged to develop anything from within. This is now known to be myopic. And also the truths that they hold tend to be insular. In other words, they apply to our culture and they don't apply to the greater universe, really. And they tend to be a little judgmental. All these are myopic concepts. Like, they're only thinking about me and my group and they're not looking at the larger picture. The other thing that's myopic in our world is our mainstream values, a lot of them. You may or may not agree with me on this, but when you think about it, power. If you need to gain power over other people, it's because you couldn't have sufficient power over yourself. So if you have enough power, you don't need power over others. So that's considered to be myopic, to think you need power over others. The idea of competition. You know, if you were satisfied, now I'm not talking about sports competition. Mary Ellen told me that somebody's going to say, well, the Cardinals? Like, I'm not talking about that kind of competition, but the thought that you need to excel over someone else is myopic. In other words, if you were satisfied from within, with your own intelligence, your own earning power, your own accomplishments, you don't care if someone else has more. Also, the idea of conformity is myopic, to think that everybody else has to believe what I believe, or everybody else has to copy my values and my lifestyle, is myopic, because if you were confident in your own beliefs, values, and lifestyle, you wouldn't care if someone else didn't follow them. And also this idea that we need continually more and more wealth, another sign of myopia. So what I plan to try to point out today is that there's a bigger story available than those two, you know, the competing religions and the values that are somewhat, you know, limited. Those conventional values, power, competition, all that, they kind of limit spiritual truth. And there is a truth available that's bigger than what most religions teach. And I believe it's also bigger than what most non-believers think they're actually rejecting. So I've tried to put this together in my book, just a little plug. It just came out last week, to the point that I don't even have a proof copy, but I don't have a real copy because it came out after I left for this trip. But anyway, I tried to put that in that book, all these concepts, but I'm going to try in the next 30 minutes to summarize for you what I'm talking about. So I've been using the word spiritual and spirituality. I'm wondering what you all think that means, and is anybody allergic to that name, to that word? I certainly was allergic to it for a long time. I'm old enough to remember a time when it used to mean somebody trying to access a paranormal reality. Okay, it used to mean, you know, you can talk to the dead, or you can foretell the future, or you're having out-of-body experiences. And I really think that that sense, that connotation is slipping away, and gradually as we go along, we're coming along to a different appreciation of the word, something more to do with human authenticity. So being authentic could be described many different ways, okay? But I'm going to skip this next slide. We'll just talk about that later. But at any rate, a new definition is emerging of the word spiritual and spirituality, and it has more to do with a kind of maturity in the way a person approaches life. And frankly, there's a whole element of what's called spirituality developing that calls you to surpass those conventional values and also to surpass typical religious beliefs. So it turns out that spirituality is something that now there's enough information we can describe what spiritual growth consists of, and we can actually describe what it's like to be spiritually immature. We can define several intermediate stages and a final point of spiritual maturity. I like this particular definition that this one man wrote. He said, in spiritual maturity, a person would be fully open to all that is, ever willing to change and to adjust in, as circumstances demand, alive always to the present moment. And this is my favorite one, responding as one ought in every situation. Boy, do I wish. Could you imagine? And in touch with the depths of one's own self, and in harmony with oneself and with all else. Now, that definition was written by Daniel Helminiak. I don't know if anybody of you know of him. It turns out he is a Roman Catholic priest. Now, I know they're in tremendous disfavor right now, but I do think this guy is kind of one of the good ones. But you'll notice that his definition of spiritual maturity has nothing to do with popular religion beliefs or supernatural beliefs, okay? It also has nothing to do with that woo-woo paranormal type of spirituality. He's talking about human authenticity. So I like to characterize this: spiritual maturity is what we get when we overcome our spiritual myopia. And I'm going to try and talk to you about this in four categories, the first one being history. Now, when I say history, I'm talking about the history of religion. And this is sort of the cliff note to the cliff note to the cliff note of the history of religion. But really, when you look back, it turns out that every culture, every human culture, has formed some type of beliefs and spiritual practices. They say that even as far back as 300,000 years ago, the Neanderthals would bury their dead, which implies that they had some respect for meaning in life or some appreciation of something other than their current reality. So you have to wonder, what were all these cultures trying to do? If you know, the literal beliefs aren't true, what were they looking for, all these cultures? They're looking for something. And the question is to figure out what that is. What's the common denominator people are looking for when they form religions or belief or spiritual practices? And then skipping forward to just the idea of Christianity, because I think that's what a lot of us are more familiar with. It turns out, you know, early Christianity was not at all about supernatural beliefs. In the time of Jesus, people were mostly, other than the aristocracy, which made up something like 1%, the lower 99% really had no personal authority, and they were treated, they're heavily mistreated by the, over-dominated by the Roman imperial system. So when Jesus' message came along and told them they had importance, that suddenly, that was news. It wasn't that they were looking for meaning in life or, you know, how did we get here, where are we going in the afterlife. They just were impressed to be told they had importance. Because up until then, you know, the way a lot of us might still see bugs, you know, if you have a bug in your house and you don't want it, you just feel free to kill it. Well, humans, other than the aristocracy, the humans were the same way. If you didn't like somebody, it's fine, just kill him, you know. So to think that their lives had meaning was a whole new idea. And that's why Christ's message was so popular. It turns out that the belief aspect was added in the 4th century, many years later, by the Emperor Constantine, who just kind of wanted to crystallize what Christianity was about and, in a way, sort of control people by telling them you have to be good, and, you know, otherwise you won't be saved. But that was an added thing added to Christianity in the 4th century. And even if these religions were revealed, you have to think each religion thinks they have a revelation. So maybe the revelation, if there is any such thing, they should consider that might have been just revealed for that time and that place. So anyway, looking at all that, I think... suggest that there might be a broader perspective on what religion and spirituality is all about. Secondly, I'm going to talk about cultural intermixing. So, up until a certain time, cultures didn't intermix much. You know, people were born in one area and they generally lived there. Well, they might have been some moving around, but nothing like there is today. So, cultures did not intermix as much. Now, we have people who live on several different continents during their lifetime. You probably have people living next door to you or working in your office, who, or maybe even marrying into your family, who are of a different culture, different religion, different race. So when you have all these cultures slapping up against each other, to maintain those insular values and insular beliefs gets ridiculous because everybody's intermixing. So, you know, we have technology has brought us tremendous intermixing. Global travel has brought us tremendous intermixing. Of course, global communications. So, through technology and whatnot, we find that knowledge is becoming democratized. You know, you can study anything you want with a few clicks of a mouse, whereas before knowledge was, you know, all siloed at the university level and the professor dispensed knowledge. But now you can study anything. So it's becoming democratized, and we can study different religions and compare and contrast what commonalities they have, to the point that literal and divisive religious beliefs kind of no longer make sense, okay? To think that it was only revealed to my people, it begins to sound ridiculous. And similarly, conventional insular values really are not sustainable either in a culturally intermixing world. And the next thing, this is one of my favorite topics is spiritual development theory. Remember I said before we can actually define what levels of spiritual development are mature and what's immature and stages in between. So I actually wrote a book about this, my first book, and came out in 2012, and that was strictly about spiritual development theory. But moving back, there's an actual trajectory that can be laid out, and in my book, I actually compared and contrasted development theories that were written by 12 different theorists, and they come from different parts of the world, different centuries, and different fields of study, yet they've all said similar things about how people mature. And it turns out that literal belief stage that most of what we think of as popular religion, where you're just told what to believe and you accept it unquestioningly, is not the first stage, but it's the lowest one we talk about. Okay, so that's not spiritual maturity. My book told stories of 10 people moving beyond that belief stage and where they wound up, how they got through it and where they wound up. So it turns out after the belief stage, if you're moving along, there's a questioning stage. Often, you know, your tribe told you all these beliefs and you were just expected to absorb them uncritically. But, you know, in today's world, an awful lot of things are happening that people are running up into what they call cognitive dissonance. So I like to use the example from my book, Kevin. All the other people in the stories, most of them were anonymous. I mean, I know them, but they wanted me to use different names, but Kevin doesn't mind me telling his story or his real name. He's a veterinarian. He lives in Canada. He is of Indian descent, but he was brought up Catholic. And at a certain point in his life, I'm going to say he was in his late 40s or early 50s, at his church, they wanted to have a blessing of the pets. And Kevin was a good friend of his pastor, and they were discussing it. And the pastor said to Kevin, it's not like animals have a soul like we humans do. Well, Kevin, he knows, he's a scientist. He knows about evolution, and he's very attached to animals. And it just hit him like a ton of bricks. What do you mean animals don't have a soul? He'd never thought about this distinction. And in the evolutionary process, when in the heck did humans develop a soul when animals don't have a soul? So this one little thing, this niggling little bothersome thing about his belief system eventually had a domino effect, so that within a number of years he had completely dismissed all of his Catholic beliefs and became a humanist, something like a secular humanist or something like that. But that's exactly what happens in this questioning stage. You don't have to move away from your beliefs, but you have to go to the point of taking responsibility for your beliefs. Okay, I have thought this through. I'm not just uncritically accepting what I was told. Often, that questioning stage leads to a rejection of belief altogether. So the first stage is, well, that's not really the first stage, but the one I'm talking about is literal belief, and then this questioning and owning things responsibly on your own is the next stage. But it turns out that's not the final stage either. And this is the bugaboo, this last stage, which is very hard to, it took me years to accept that this stage even existed. But there tends to be a mellowing and an openness to paradox and unity. So let me just break that out a little bit. So in the mellowing stage, in the person's head, they develop a more complex reasoning style. So things are not black and white, like either humans have a soul or animals don't, or it doesn't have to be as black and white as that. Many concepts, I don't have time to go into, but many concepts become paradoxical, and that's okay. You don't need that simplistic answer. The person's heart expands beyond self-interest. It just happens that as this stage happens, the person widens their sense of what's important to them. It's not just about me, it's not just about my group, but they kind of expand to a larger, they're not just interested in their own well-being, and that their worldview expands to include everyone and expands toward unity. I'm going to break that out a little bit. So in these stages, now I didn't mention the pre-religious stage, but the pre-religious stage, you have the person is all about themselves. They're manipulative, they're chaotic, they're narcissistic. You might know somebody like this. Not to mention their names, but they are at that pre-religious stage, okay? And then if they become a literal believer, that's actually a step up. They have expanded their worldview to include everybody in their group. It might be all Lutherans. It might be all Muslims. It might be all Democrats. It might be all Republicans. The point is they have accepted a group as being all of us are important. That's a sign of spiritual growth. And then at the questioning stage, the person tends to open their worldview a little farther. And they kind of like all people. Here's where you find they're very attached to social justice and human rights and equality and even maybe animal rights and maybe ecology. So they're expanding their worldview to include more. But then that tells us that something else happens at the mellowing stage. What are they going to include that the other people don't? So obviously they're going to include all humans, all animals, all of nature. But some people in that questioning stage also, include all that. So you might or might not like this, but at the mellowing stage, the person includes the unseen aspects of their existence. So it might mean that they trust when they get an intuitive hit, they know it means something. Or it might be that they suddenly know someone who's close to them is ill and they just know without being told. But these are people who don't reject that kind of message. They take it and they believe it. So, looking at this trajectory of spiritual growth in the individual, does suggest also a new understanding of what religion and spirituality are about. It puts it in a different perspective, I think. And lastly, I'm going to run through this one sort of quickly, human cultural development. I'm by far not an expert on this, but a lot of people have written to show how cultures overall go through stages very similar to human spiritual development. So remember the spiritual development theory in humans is belief, questioning, mellowing, okay? And it turns out that in societal in Western society, progress has been happening in the same trajectory. In pre-modernity, the individual was not important. They had no authority. They were told told by their king or their religious leader what to believe. So it's similar to the belief stage. And then the printing press came along and opened things up so that people got more and more authority of their own, and they started to figure they can figure things out through the scientific method, through reason, through studying philosophy, and that's similar to the questioning stage. And then one of my favorite things to say, people don't necessarily accept this thought, but modernity is sort of ending, kind of thought to have ended in the end of the 20th century. So even if you say something is modern, it means it's maybe a little old-fashioned. And we're now moving into post-modernity, and what's opening this up is, the internet and all cultural intermixing. So what the printing press did for modernity, it says that the internet is doing for post-modernity. Now, signs, and you might not believe me at this point, but signs that post-modernity is opening us up to this mellowing include the interfaith movement. So, interfaith started maybe 30, 40 years ago, where before that, I'm old enough to remember, I was brought up Catholic and remember being told, you do not speak to anyone who's not Catholic, okay? Now, with the interfaith movement, they're coming up, they meet together to speak in respect and compare beliefs and, rituals and things with people of other faiths. For the sake of mutual understanding, they're not trying to mix them together, they just want to talk. So that's a sign of they're opening up to the other. And then, the word N-O-N-E-S, this is people who is very, very prominent in the millennial generation. They don't belong to any religion. They may or may not be a little bit spiritual in some sense, in terms of human authenticity, not woo-woo stuff, but they are not religious. And if you look at the graphs, every year the data comes out, the millennials are rising like this, the number of nuns, N-O-N-E-S. So what's going to happen to our traditional religions who are mostly populated by baby boomers? Think about it. And then we have the interspirituality movement, which is different from interfaith. Okay, interfaith, they just meet to talk and compare practices and things, but there's no hope to mix them together. In interspirituality, they're looking for a bigger picture, like what is common to all humans that causes them to search for meaning in life and connection. And that's kind of where the inner spirituality movement is moving. So the trajectory I'm trying to show is that in a very loose sense, culturals kind of move in the same direction as individual spiritual development. And there are people who've written far more detailed analysis of this than I could possibly ever do on people much more schooled in history and sociology and whatnot. But we are moving in, believe it or not, I believe, we are moving in a more civilized direction and towards less violence in our culture. And this implies continual cultural progress. Now, I think at this point, if you all had tomatoes, you'd be throwing them at me. Because nobody thinks, if you turn on the television or the radio or anything, it doesn't sound like we're having any kind of cultural progress, right? But that's because the divisive elements are making a tremendous amount of noise right now, but I think there's a bigger picture going on, and I hope to present, these are not definitive, but four perspectives that I think give me hope, and I hope that maybe I can share something with you that might bring you hope. First is, the example of it is Steven Pinker. He wrote a book in 2010 called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And he shows with 700 pages of charts and graphs and studies showing that dramatically the number of violent crimes and murders over millennia has decreased per percentage of the population, over centuries has decreased dramatically, and even over decades. Now, he wrote this in 2010, before all the school shootings, but I still think the numbers are declined. Per percentage of the population, there are more people now. We hear more about stuff that happens, but if you take percentage of the population, that is declining dramatically. The second one, I love this this guy, Jim Kenney, Thriving in the Cross Current, Clarity and Hope in the Time of Cultural Sea Change. So he compares what's going on in our culture, the values that are changing and whatnot, to what happens in a sea, in the ocean. So if you have a new wave forming, and an old wave is receding. There's a point where the two mix, and at that point there's tremendous chaos. There's all kinds of cross currents and eddies, and it's very hard to tell what direction things are moving, and it could be very scary in that spot. So he compares that to what's happening in our culture, and he claims that we have old values are declining right now, and new values are emerging. And let me just break that out a little bit. The old values that he claims are declining: power, wealth, competition, conformity, insularity, and self-importance. So what might be moving towards? So instead of having power over others, we want everyone to have human rights. Instead of wealth, there is a notion of having more sharing. Now, you don't hear about it a lot because, you know, the power people are making a lot of noise and the wealth people are making a lot of noise, but it is happening at a grassroots level. Competition is becoming a little bit outmoded, and they're moving towards cooperative measures. Conformity is no longer as important. We're starting to respect diversity. Insularity and exclusion is giving way to inclusion, and self-importance is giving way to people recognizing ways in which we are all interdependent. Similarly, we have human rights. Human rights. Okay, next one should be, here we go. Pollution, you know, used to be considered, you know, no problem with pollution in the 50s, and now we're looking at ecology. Racism was also, when I was young, no problem, and now we're looking at equality. Competition giving way to self-governance, conformity. Oh, wait, I'm looking at the wrong thing again. So authority, outer authority is, you know, people are starting to respect the importance of self-governance. The legitimacy of war is actually falling away, and peace is rising as a value. And religious exclusivity is giving way to interspirituality, or some recognition of things that bind us instead of things that divide us. And divisiveness is giving way to unity. So back at this thing, we see those old values are in decline. New values are coming up. And of course, where do we find ourselves right now? Right here. So in the midst of the turbulence. And that's why it sounds so crazy, you know, but to me it's hopeful to think, maybe not in my lifetime, but maybe hopefully in my children's lifetime, those new values will ascend. Of course, Jim Kenney is careful to point out that no sooner the new values ascend, they become obsolete and even better values will arise, and these will be descending again. So it's just a process that repeats itself, but I take hope with the values I like are coming forward. Perspective number three that I wanted to talk about is, and it's funny, Mary Ellen and Angie and I were talking about something last night, and she came out with this herself, a different aspect of it I wasn't totally familiar with. But, you know, if you have a child who's maturing in certain stages, he's developing in a certain skill, there's often a period in which he loses that skill and right before he takes the next step. So you have a toddler who speaks 20 words and suddenly just starts babbling and nothing makes any sense, and then he emerges with a complete sentence. Or you have a grade schooler who you have to really ride on him to get him to do his homework, and then suddenly won't do anything right before he emerges and starts getting ready to do his own homework. And then Mary Ellen brought in a more of a psychology thing, like if a person is developing a certain way as an adult, past a particular something that's been limiting, they might take a step backwards before they emerge. So really, if you can look at that at a societal level, I think, you know, there's always chaos or regression before a developmental leap. So if you think we are regressing right now, I think it's because we have a developmental leap coming forward. By far, I'm not the only person to say this. I try to say it in simpler words than most of the people who write about this, but we do think a developmental leap is coming. The fourth perspective is that of the pendulum. I was given a talk a few years ago, and someone raised her hand very nicely, and she said, so you mean the pendulum may swing backwards and forwards, but the fulcrum is always moving forward. So, it didn't come through. I had a drawing. So just to remind you what a pendulum is, it's something heavy, something like a metal ball, suspended from a string or a chain from a point of support at the top called the fulcrum. Okay, the fulcrum is suspending the chain and the ball. So if you move the ball back, it's going to swing backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. But if you can trust that the fulcrum is always moving forward, then every time the pendulum swings backward, it goes back not quite as far as it did before, and every time it moves forward, it moves a little farther forward than it did before. So if you can apply that to our culture, if you swing, we might say, most of us might agree, at this point in time, we are strictly in a backward swing of our cultural pendulum. But, you know, face it, we aren't going back to slavery, and we aren't going back to women barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. We're not going back that far. And so it's swinging backwards, it's not going to go back as far as it was. And when it swings forward, it's going a little farther forward than it did before. So think back 30 or 40 years, did it ever occur to you that in 2018 we would be talking about rights for transgender people, just for example? No. So we are moving forward at the same time we're moving backwards. It's not as bad as it looks. This is our chaos that we're in the middle of, the turbulence of cultural sea change. So in the overall trajectory, I believe society is moving beyond literal separate religious beliefs, popular religion, toward a broader perspective based on a more complete understanding of the human drive for connection with something greater than the self. And I break that out a lot in my book. I don't think I have time today. And we're also moving beyond insular conventional values toward a mellowing intermixing of cultures, a new appreciation for inner authority instead of outer authority, and the value of an inclusive worldview, you know, not just my group, but like everyone. And so these more developed reasoning styles are being necessitated by an ever more complex society. I don't know how you all feel about this, but to me, I feel we now have a greater chance than ever to move beyond the limitations of spiritually myopic limitations of literal belief systems and insular values. And to me, that's good news, and I hope you all sort of think similarly. So, thank you. So, I don't know, I was told I could open it up to questions or comments or anything.
A couple minutes, yeah.
What?
We have a few minutes.
Couple minutes, okay. Yes, hi.
Hi, I grew up in more than one religion, and I'm sure that you touched on the research versus, you know, the research sample that you did. Most of the people that I've spoken to, especially in this society, about our personal journeys, how we came to this value system, or people who, as a child, their parents, if I can use that word, you know, their caretakers allowed them to attend other places of worship, faith, to question on their own, and did not discourage them from other views. Do you speak to that? In your sample, is that, I mean, everybody has their own story, but if I had to pick one majority of what allowed people to come to this society, or people who even do not have a belief, who I found on a Facebook group that we met up together, it was people who were allowed to question by their
significant elders. Well, it's sometimes it's people who are allowed, and some people who got there by great struggle. They were not allowed. And yet, whatever their society, their tribe was telling them was so horrible to them that they had to struggle through it. And that's a lot harder than people who are invited to question. You know, in my case, I was not invited to question. I was brought up strictly Catholic, but I went to deliberately to learn more about religion. I went to the Catholic University of America for undergraduate school, and there we were taught to question. Shock of all shocks! It was right after Vatican II, and you know, you were going to get an F if you gave catechism answers. You had to think things through. So, this is why I came here. Reason. Okay, I'm done with Catholicism. You know, so it could be many factors that draw you that way. But you're right, that's one of them, certainly. People are invited by their significant elders to question. Yes, hi. Yes.
One of the applications of this, excuse me, I didn't know I was going to talk, is the comparison of culture in Europe as opposed to the United States, and you can see how Europe is much closer to, or much farther ahead of us.
You know, I so agree with you, and yet so many people wouldn't see it that way, but they are. They're like they're Catholic in name only, but you know, they're like, they don't really buy into it much. And I think you're right. It's probably because they intermix more, because the next culture is just a few miles away.
Somebody told me recently that they have almost nobody in Europe. That's an overgeneralization. Mm-hmm. They are not religious anymore, but they mm-hmm. they respect their churches keep them up and their existence.
And I also understand that in Europe, as to some extent in the United States, who's populating our churches is not the white educated people so much. It's the immigrants like Latinos and things, you know, who are more amenable to the literal beliefs. You know, so. Yes. Hi. Yes.
A couple of points. The whole thing about questioning, and I was brought up also very Catholic and not invited to question. Mm-hmm. When you talk about societies, this is a completely different point out. When you talk about societies following the same path,
mm-hmm.
how then, you know, when we look at ancient societies that are in such turmoil, you know, mm-hmm. if you go to the Middle East, to me that doesn't seem to be following that path, because they are stuck in.
Mm-hmm. But did they have as much access to information as the Western world had in the time of the printing press? You know what I mean? Did those societies have access so that their individuals were learned to question? At points they did. Okay, so I'm not a historian. I don't want to dismiss your question, but the sources that I have based this on weren't talking about Middle Eastern, they're talking about Western society. So, okay. Yes, hi.
This gives me a new perspective on Christian family members and a few friends I have that are still at, how they feel that there is a war going on against them when they're in them. Like, oh, you're crazy. There's no physical war going on against you, but I can see that in this background thing that it's, you know, what you're saying is ascending.
Yeah.
It's like filtering in, and that's where they think there's a war.
So a lot of these wars are backlash against something that can't be stopped. You can't stop globalization and internet and technology, so they feel, you know, my insular values and beliefs are being threatened by this horrible, you know, thing that's happening. Or they can't maybe articulate that, but they do feel threatened. So anyway, do we have...
One more, let's go.
Okay. Yeah.
I just want to thank you
for
offering help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so cool that an eye doctor helped with my
office. Thank you.
Just to have that understanding of the pendulum or of the descending and, you know, the chaos where we are.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's hard to step back and really look at that.
Uh-huh.
So thank you for rubbing my mind.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for your comment. I appreciate that. So, all right. Well, thanks so much. This has been really fun. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Thank you very much. Any more connection baskets? Oh, right. Dr. Johnson has a few of the books on this table back there, the welcoming table. They're for sale. How much?
Only the first book. The second book is available on Amazon, but I don't have any yet.
Right.
But
okay.
It's $15.
They're $15, so. Thank you. So this comes from Sarah Vigie. We have new coffee makers, and the old ones have been refurbished. Does anybody need a coffee maker? We have two. Maybe for a small donation, they can be yours. Or if nobody wants them, they can be yours anyhow.
Only used once a week by a little old lady on Sundays.
There you go. Wait a minute, I made coffee this morning.
That's the new coffee maker.
Well, that's true. This comes from Susan. This is probably a tag on to last week's discussion. I brought in some literature on Crossroads Clinic and coordinated per entry per our discussion last week. The information is on the table, Susan. So, thank you. And then many thanks to Danielle and John who helped us with the Youth in Need dinner. That's from the Carters. So I got a few announcements. Next week is a fifth Sunday Oh,